So, if you're sitting comfortably, I will begin. Dear Ajahn, could you please say a few words again on the causes of stillness? The cause of stillness is letting go. And in order to let go, especially let go of doing things, we have to stop wanting things. And when we stop wanting things, one of the nice ways of stopping wanting things is to let go of all past and future. Because if you really let go of all past and future, there's no place where wanting can go. If you want something, you want something in the future, you want to change the past. But if your whole perception of past and future are really gone, you can't want anything. When you can't want anything, you can't do anything. When you can't do anything, you're still. And the stillness just grows and grows in intensity. That's one of the reasons why we, you know, spend a lot of time focusing on the present moment and letting go of your past and letting go of your future. And even though that was the first exercise which I gave you all on this retreat, still you can always remember that exercise and continue doing that exercise throughout the retreat. And if things aren't going well on the retreat, strengthen the present moment awareness. You're here. So stop going places, stop doing stuff for the future, and just stay more in this moment. And you all know that this moment, this is where your future is made. This is the only time you can do anything about your future, right now. So imagine if you can just look after this present moment, care for it, be kind to it, relax in it, be peaceful in this moment. That's the best you can possibly do for the future. So those of you who are concerned about your future, stay more in the present moment. And then you find that you don't want anything. This present moment is a very nice place to be in. So that's why we stay here. And please remind me to tell you the story tomorrow, one of my favourite stories, of the old monks don't lie story. It's all about being in the present moment. Dear Ajahn, as a monk, do you go to gala dinners or do you only accept lunch and breakfast invitations? I once went to dinner with the Queen of England, Australia, whatever she was. I was invited to a state dinner. That's, you know, way up above the gala dinners. And that was when Queen Elizabeth came for the what's it called, the Commonwealth Games. And I told you the story before about, you know, the dress code. That was very difficult, but I got in under because they had three types of dresses. There was a nice invitation from John Howard, signed by him. And they invited me to go to the gala dinner. Not the gala dinner, the state dinner, sorry, in Parliament House. And there was three possibilities. One was black tie. We don't have a black tie, not one, in the whole monastery. And I was really wondering, is that all you have to wear? You know, no shirt, no trousers, just a black tie. That's what it said. Because, you know, you got to... I don't know, I'm only a monk. I don't know these things. The second option was military uniform. You can't have a monk going dressed as a soldier. That's... So those are the first two options. But the third option, you know, the third option was a long dress. It was. And I thought, oh, I can go. So I went there. It was really good fun. I love doing stuff like that. And of course, I went to the Parliament House in Canberra, and as soon as you walked in, got stopped by security. I had my invite, so I said, here, I can go in. So they let me in. But it was a dinner. So monks can't eat, you know, the stuff which was on offer there. But this was like really high class. So they have these things called protocol officers. They find out, you know, what monks can eat. And I was very impressed. So that when everyone else was having their first, you know, salad course, I had a plate of cheese. That's really nice cheese, not the rubbish you get. I'm not, shouldn't say that here. I mean, it's really top quality. And then they took all the plates away, And then they gave the second course, which was something roast lamb or something. And then for me, it was a different type of cheese, like camembert was the next one. Really delicious stuff. And the last one, you know, when they had their dessert, was, I remember it was macadamia pie or something. That's what everyone else had. And for me, it was dark chocolate. It was a three-course meal. Two cheeses and one chocolate. Just like you have every evening. And so somebody had done the research, and I was really impressed, you know, that what they actually got up to. So that's when I go to state dinners, that's what I eat. Cheese and chocolate. That's what we eat now. So that's what we did. It was good fun. Dear Ajahn, you said yesterday that ghosts cannot harm us, but can negative energies do, or so-called spells, or voodoo? How those kind of energy can work on us, human, and what's the best way to protect us? Is there such a thing, or is it in our mind? Yeah, there are these little beings and demons people can hire to sort of mess up with you, but they can only work if you are sort of, you've got some weakness somewhere. Either way, you're very sick already, or, you know, you're just, you don't keep precepts. The best defense is people who keep their precepts, and they can't harm you. Okay, there's a couple of stories, but the one I like the best is one of the Thai ladies, you know, who was here a long time ago. She died a long time ago. But she was one of the first supporters of our monastery over here, and a really good girl. And she got her mother to come over, because her father had died. No one was really looking after her mum in Thailand. So she got her mother to come on one of these visas, and she looked after her mother so well. It was so impressive to see, you know, the Asian tradition that, you know, your mother is sick, you know, you just sleep by her bedside. You don't go home. And so her mother was getting very sick in hospital because she was old. And this girl told me that she decided to try and find out whether her mother's going to survive this illness by going to one of these spirit doctors, these mediums. So she went to this medium in Perth, and paid, I think it was $20, really cheap. And she said, all I need to know is, you know, your mother's name, the hospital, the ward, and the room number, and I'll go and check her out for you. And so they gave her $20, and this woman in Perth, she went into a trance. You know, she fell unconscious. She was doing like the astral travel business, you know, leaving her body. And that's why she wanted to know the address of the hospital and the room number and everything else. And after about 10 or 15 minutes, she came out of her trance. And the first thing she did was to give the $20 back to this Thai girl. And she said, no, what's happened? Couldn't you find my mum? She said, no, I found her all right. I went to the hospital, I found the ward, I found the room, but I couldn't get inside. She said, your mother had a force field around her. I'd never seen anything like this before. And I just couldn't penetrate it. I couldn't find out, you know, penetrate, get close enough to find out what your mother's going to whether she's going to survive or not. And so who the heck is your mum anyway? I've never seen this before. Oh, my mother's a Buddhist nun. She's been a Buddhist nun for about 30 years. At which the medium snatched the $20 back. You should have told me beforehand. You've been wasting my time. People like me can't get close to people like that. I mean, that was just one example of many. That this is actually, in that sort of realm of existence, that's actually how you appear. Because there's a huge force field around you. So then any demons, voodoo stuff and other, they can't get close to you. They can't penetrate you. They can't get in. And that's what happens. So if you keep your precepts, you know, you're a good person, a kind person, you're just invulnerable to these people. So much more power than they have. That's why even there was another case. There was this, she was this medium lady. She brought an indigenous elder, an Aboriginal elder, to Bodhinyana Monastery once. But she left the elder at the gate. And she came to talk to me, and it was only afterwards she told me that she brought her friend with her, but the friend said, I can't get in the gate. There's too much power in here. And because they were very sensitive. And I scolded that lady, Barbara her name was, and told her, look, you should have asked me first of all. You should have told me that he was staying out there. All he needed was permission, and he could have come in. But you know, these are like powers and around places and around people. And that's why that, you know, if you're a good person, you may not realize it, but you've got force field around you and voodoo stuff, and they just can't get close to you. They can't harm you. So, you know, that's, You may not believe it, I can't prove it, just I know it. So during present moment awareness, we guard against thought, perception of the past and the future. Therefore, after we go deeper by guarding inner speech. Ajahn, can you please explain the difference between thought and inner speech? Aren't they the same? Yeah, they are the same. So that's why the thought and the inner speech, they're mostly the same. I should mention that sometimes that you can actually move the mind. It's almost nothing is said. But the mind moves in the right direction. It's the difference between, this is just a simple exercise. I am going to say a word now, and I want you to also notice, be mindful of the reaction to this word inside of you. So don't just listen to the word, see what happens afterwards. Peace. 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 Because when the word finishes, it leaves an echo. Quite automatically, without you even doing anything, the mind goes in the direction of that word, what it actually means. So I said it 3 or 4 or 5 times to reinforce, what is that word pointing to? What's it trying to describe? And when the word finishes, the mind can start to feel its meaning. Peace. And you have what the word means without any movement of the mind. You have peace. The trouble is that we don't use our thought very well. It's just one thought follows after another. So we don't really know what these words are pointing to. But when we actually start to be quiet, we understand the difference between the inner speech and actually what it's trying to describe. So, after a while you don't need the words anymore. You just have what they're trying to describe. And that's why in deep meditation you can just, you know what peace is. You know what metta is. You don't have to say metta. You just get the subverbal meaning of metta and get it in your head, and then you've got loving kindness as much as you want. So, but generally speaking, thoughts and inner speech are the same. Is it a bad karma, a partner to object the other becoming a monk? Okay. So you've got a partner, or he wants to become a monk and you don't want him to become a monk. Oh, what should you do? And this is a trouble sometimes. I remember one young man I ordained as a novice, and his girlfriend was at the ordination. And I know that people are usually happy at the ordination, but she wasn't. She was looking at me as if, she was trying to do a voodoo smell on me. She was so unhappy. I'm taking away my boyfriend. She was really upset about it. But look, sometimes it's a very difficult thing that, remember, in a relationship you have to work together. So it should never be your decision, it should be our decision. So your partner should be really quite happy and be quite proud and just be quite supportive of your aspiration to be a monk. And if you can get the okay with your partner, then that's wonderful. And if you can't, then sometimes I might say, well, just don't ordain yet. Wait until she's happy with your ordaining. And as for your partner, be a bit careful, because if you do stop your partner ordaining, and that's what he or she really wants to do, that's going to really mess up your relationship. There's something he always wanted to do, and you actually stop him. I know a lot of times people have all these romantic ideas of what it's like, to be a monk. So what you do, you just let him stay in a monastery for a couple of weeks, digging holes and cleaning toilets. And then after a while you say, no, okay, I'm going back to my wife or my partner. So, that's one of the best things. Okay, off you go, come become a monk. And then after a while he runs back to you. So that's one thing you can try and do. Just, let him give it a try and he realizes it's not for him. Or he just misses you. So that's, I wouldn't object to him becoming a monk. I'd say, oh, give it a try, see what happens. And if you're really, really clever, say, oh, just off you go, go and become a monk. There's this guy I know. He says, what? Oh, no, it's okay, just become a monk. Make him jealous or something, so he never goes off to become a monk. But if he really, 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 really wants to, then fine, it's a wonderful thing to do. As five senses disappear during meditation, you see your mind in its purest form in deep jhanas. What is this mind and when does it come from? When you dive into deepest levels of jhanas, does mind cease to exist at any point, leading to nothingness? Yeah, this is what happens, what the jhanas are. First of all, they're deep stages of stillness. Remember what stillness means is you're not having any will, you're not doing anything. So this part of you, the doer, the will, the chooser, the driver of your life, that vanishes, and that's an important part of your mind. That's, you know, what most people think, you know, that is what they think they are. I'm the one who decides and takes responsibility for my actions and does this and does that and makes sure that I'm trying to seek happiness. And I often mention that many people come to a religion or come to especially a path like Buddhism because they have the assumption that, as you know, that the will isn't a bad thing, it's just stupid sometimes. If only I can learn how to train my will to be smart, not make so many mistakes, then I'll be happy. So you really come here to empower your will with wisdom and compassion, and then everything will be okay. But when you come here, you'll find that, no, the will itself is the problem. That's the problem. It stops you being still, and it's totally out of control. So after a while, you start to let go of the will. It becomes still. Then you go into incredibly peaceful, beautiful states. And now once you know what the will is, because it's disappeared, you realize it's just a pain in the neck. So you learn how to let go even more. And that's where part of you ceases to exist. And the other part which ceases to exist is this thing called consciousness. First of all, the five sense consciousnesses go. Then you know what the mind consciousness is, and then that starts to fade away as well. Until there's nothing left. But sometimes people think of nothingness as a thing. You go into the great emptiness, the great void, which is another thing. That's why it's so difficult because, you know, there's many, many stories. And I like the Lewis Carroll story of, you know, Alice, I forget, it was through the wonder, I think it was Alice in the Looking Glass or something, through the Looking Glass. That was when she finally went to the place where the Red Queen was. And when she arrived, the Red Queen said, "Did you see anyone on the way here?" And Alice said, "I saw nobody on the way here." "Wow, what good eyes you have. It's hard enough for me to see someone. But yeah, you girl can see nobody. Wow, you've got very good eyes." And a short time later, her messenger came. And he asked the messenger, "Did you see anybody on the road?" And the messenger says, "I saw no one." "Quite correct, this girl saw no one too." And he said, "Did anybody pass you on the road?" she asked the messenger. He said, "Nobody passed me on the road." "You mean nobody walked faster than you, and I hire you as my fastest messenger?" "Well, I do try and walk as fast as I can, Your Majesty." So what they were doing, they were making nobody a person, as if that was their name. That's why sometimes you see people with this t-shirt, it's one of the nice t-shirts. It says, "Nobody is better than God. I'm a nobody." No, so "Nobody is perfect," it says. "Nobody is perfect. I'm a nobody, therefore I'm perfect." They're just messing around with language, making nobody a person, making nothing a thing, making emptiness the final holiday home for enlightened beings, where you can live happily ever after. Unfortunately, it's not like that. So everything ceases to exist. Poof, gone forever. Dear Ajahn, you say that when the mind is still, the attention naturally goes to the breath because it's the only thing moving. What about the heart beating? Good question. When my mind is still, and even sometimes when the breath seems to stop, I still feel very strongly the heartbeat pulsing throughout the body, sometimes even accompanied by heat. It's not very peaceful, usually. Exactly. That is a problem. More people are aware of the breathing than the heartbeat. But as soon as you start looking at it, it's there, and it's so difficult to remove once it's in your perception. So that's usually, the breath is the usual way for most people, and the heartbeat is not a problem. But if that does happen to you, the solution is that simile I gave this morning of the TV set. You know, what's, you know, on the edges disappears after a while. As long as you don't put the disturbance in the center of your screen, then it sort of vanishes. So the way to deal with that problem is, yeah, you can, you know the heartbeat, but make sure you also know the breathing, the rhythm of your lungs. And put the breathing in the center. That's the one you're really focusing on. And the heartbeat, you're not trying to get rid of it, it's actually on the edge. It's not the center of your screen. The center of the screen is the breathing. That's the most important. So you're watching the breath go in, the breath go out. You can feel the heartbeat, but it's on the edge. It's not in the center. And it's only a matter of time when actually the heartbeat just disappears by itself. You don't know when it disappears, but you know it has disappeared. So you're just focusing, keeping the center on the main thing. And then all the other disturbances, distractions, noises, heartbeat, feelings in the body, that eventually vanishes. It's just now noticing about focusing. If you really want to try this now, focus on my head, and after a while my body vanishes. If you really focus on my nose, after a while you can't see my ears. You just focus in all the time. So you've got, you know, your breath, you've got the heartbeat, you've got other stuff going on. Put the breath right in the very center. That's what you focus on. The heartbeats may be a little to the right or the left, but soon that's totally vanished. That is the best way of dealing with a heartbeat problem if it ever comes up. But it's true, it's very disturbing. And you can't calm your heartbeat. If you really do calm your heartbeat and it stops, you're in big trouble. And so am I. So you're dead. The Ajahn Brahm, do you know about NYC? That's New York City, isn't it? About NYC Pragmatic Dharma, the Hamilton Project. No, I don't know that at all. How about Mahasi Soyodaw meditation? Yeah, do they lead to Nibbana too? If you don't know, please don't read. It's a waste of time putting that on the end of the question. Now, instead of actually saying about this meditation and that meditation, wherever there's the Eightfold Path, they will lead to Nibbana. So I don't know what the Hamilton Pragmatic Dharma is, but if there's Eightfold Path there, then of course it will lead to Nibbana. Which means you have to have precepts. You know, you have to have virtue, right speech, right action, right livelihood. And some people know that, especially in places like the United States, they say, oh, you don't need all that precept stuff. Just, you know, you can have sex, but don't get attached to it. They say that, you know, and it's like crazy stuff. Don't have sex with anybody, you know, don't be attached. You know, take drugs, but you know, just let go afterwards. Come on, I mean, this isn't against the precepts. And if you are breaking precepts, basically no right speech, no right action, no right livelihood, which means, you know, the Eightfold Path is not there. You know, you do need right mindfulness, effort, the effort to say no, the effort to stop. And you do need samadhi, which is stillness. So each one of those, and the right stillness is always a jhanas. You do need those things to become enlightened. So you always check whatever method they're teaching, as long as it's the Eightfold Path there, all the eight factors, you know, then it's going to lead to enlightenment. If one of them or more of them are missing, it's not going to get there. Dear Ajahn Brahm, sometimes when I am calm after meditation, I feel my heartbeat, pulse stop. It's all silent inside for a few seconds and then continue as normal. Phew. This does not happen often, but is there any connection to the gaps between the breaths that you have been talking about and the gaps between the heartbeat? Could be. I mean, sometimes it's just the heart is, you know, it knows what to beat and how long to beat and what to do. And if it doesn't need to sort of pump much blood through the system, everything is well oxygenated, then it'll probably just pause for a little while. So it's okay for the time being. As long as it's natural, and then usually there'll be no problem at all. And, you know those stories, if you get very deep in meditation, and this really starts to shock some doctors, but it's true, if you get very deep in meditation, you know, your heart doesn't pump at all. It stops beating. And you're perfectly healthy. You know, that was, there's many stories, but one of those stories is Ajahn Chah. You know, he had his stroke, so he could not speak for, I don't know how many years, about 8-9 years, I think, before he passed away. So during that time, he was in a wheelchair, just looked after by the monks and by one doctor, or one sort of medic, rather. And this was one story I was told. It happened apparently many times. The one evening, there was two or three monks looking after him, plus the medic, and Ajahn Chah stopped breathing and no pulse. And the medic was there, and he just freaked out. We'd better get him to hospital, he's dying. And the monk said, no, no, forget about that. He's just in deep meditation. And of course, you know, the doctors don't believe that sort of stuff. So they did this great experiment. And the experiment was the doctor was going to take blood samples every few minutes just to make sure the blood was well oxygenated. And he did that every few minutes. He took some blood samples and the blood was always well oxygenated, even though Ajahn Chah was not breathing at all. And, you know, that meant the, as long as there's oxygen in the blood, then you know, everything's going to be okay. It's just when there's no oxygen in there that things start to die. So there was a case, Ajahn Chah was not breathing at all, and still plenty of oxygen, you know, in his system, which meant he was obviously alive. And that's what happens in deep meditation, you know, you stop breathing. But it's also in very deep meditation, the heart stops as well. And that was that fellow over in Perth who, I love telling this story, so you've heard it before, this is a golden oldie, but it's a true story. He was meditating at home on a Sunday afternoon, nothing on, you know, he was not a great meditator, just nothing on TV. So he decided to go to his room to meditate for half an hour, told his wife, and after an hour and a half he hadn't come out of his bedroom. So, you know, the wife goes to check on him and sees him sitting in perfect meditation posture, absolutely still, too still. She couldn't see his abdomen go up and down. He wasn't breathing. So she rang the emergency number, you know, 000 in Australia. And she rang the 000 number, and in 5 minutes, you know, the ambulance came, screaming into their driveway, rushing out, feeling this guy's pulse. There was no pulse there at all. He wasn't breathing. So straight into the ambulance, you know, top speed to the hospital, which was Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital here in Perth. Straight into the emergency room, and putting ECGs and EEGs on him. They were both flat. There was no heart activity and no brain activity either. It's a perfectly flat line. And, you know, usually he would have gone down to the morgue, but on that particular day, it's amazing this, you know, how these things happen, you know, good fortune or whatever, was that the doctor on duty was an Indian guy. And, you know, his parents had told him that, you know, some meditators can get into deep meditation, deep samadhi, and suspend all their life activities. And because, you know, his wife had told the doctor he'd been meditating before, nothing else, the doctor thought it might be that he's just in deep meditation. So he kept on putting these defibrillators on his body, you know, the electric shocks, to try and get his heart going again. And apparently many, 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 many times, according to his wife, they tried to revive him using electric shocks. Nothing worked at all. Until he decided, this is what he said to me, he said he decided to come out of his meditation. And as soon as, you know, he came out of his meditation, he opened his eyes, beep, beep, everything was perfect. No problem at all. And of course the doctor was really shocked, surprised, what's going on. But the doctor gave him a thorough examination. He was perfectly healthy, nothing wrong with him at all. And so after that experience, the doctor actually allowed him to walk home with his wife. You know, not even sort of go in a car or an ambulance because it's not that far away. And he said, no problem at all. And during that period, you know, he was just experiencing incredible bliss. And, you know, he couldn't feel those electric shocks. You know, he could hear the sirens and all that activity, all these people, you know, getting sort of desperately trying to keep him alive. He couldn't hear anything. His five senses were totally shut down. And his heart, because he was in the hospital, you know, he had all his machines on him. total flat lines, no brain activity, no heart activity, but perfectly okay. Just that sixth sense, the mind. It was not the brain, it was the mind working, and so happy, having the greatest time of his life. So that's a true story. So you know, this is what happens sometimes. Yes, the heart can stop in a deep meditation, but when it stops in that deep meditation, you're perfectly okay. Nothing can harm you. And even the other story I like to tell, in case you get afraid, because you know, people are just so scary cats, and they've got just no courage at all. So you don't have to worry at all, because there's a story in the suttas of this monk, tell this on every retreat, this monk who was meditating in the jungle, and he was obviously in a very deep meditation, because when two Buddhist villagers came past, they too thought he was dead, because they couldn't see him breathing. And these were really faithful, devout Buddhists. And so they thought, it's not correct to leave a monk dead in the jungle where he could get eaten up by the animals. The right thing to do, because we're Buddhists, is to give this monk a proper cremation. So while you know, this monk was in his jhanas, you know, the villagers you know, gathered some wood, put the monk on top, and lit the fire. That's in the suttas. And so when the flames are up there, you know that you guys, you're busy, you know, you can't just hang around all day for the cremation to carry on. It's going to be burnt out now because you can see it's happening. So they went off to collect their vegetables and mushrooms, whatever they were doing in the forest, and they're leaving the monk to be cremated. And the next morning they were very impressed when they saw the monk walk into the village on arms round. No injury on him at all. And even his robe was intact. No burn marks on the robe. And he said, now that's actually something which happens. If you get into these deep jhanas, it's amazing. There's something supernatural there. You can't be destroyed. So if you do go into a jhana, and they do think you're dead, and they do put you in the crematorium, you know, in the ovens, they put you in there and they close the door. You know, once the fire has gone out, they open the door, hi, me again. You'll survive. It'll be really cool when that happens. Get your name in the papers. But so you're perfectly safe. So, you know, if this happens naturally, you've got no problems. Ajahn, thanks for your time. You know the five stages of grief and loss. One of them is anger. You said, allow anxiety to come, embrace depression. But when one reacts to trigger, why not one supposed to explode the imploded anger and let it dissolve and vanish? Why should one back it, block it away by having grateful thoughts? Is venting out anger not being grateful? And now this is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and she, you know, she just noticed most people, especially her clients in the United States, you know, they have these stages. But not all people are from the United States. And sometimes that's the trouble with psychology. They describe, you know, US people instead of describing other people. It's some of the psychology you have is actually culturally specific. And that is why it just does not work on, say, Thai people. And you know, some of the Thai people that come to me and said, well, I had to go to counselor. I don't know what this counselor is on about. I'm supposed to be angry. And I'm not angry. But you're supposed to be angry. But I'm not. But get angry, otherwise you can't get you through to the next stage. And sometimes it is culturally specific, which is one of the big problems, you know, with teaching. And, you know, different cultures respond in different ways. So those five steps, they're not the same with all cultures. Which is why this amazing thing in Northeast Thailand, where I spent 9 years, is totally different from Bangkok. The south of Thailand and the north of Thailand is almost like a different world. It was never ever had been colonized by the West. In fact, much of it was so remote in those days that this is absolutely true, that in some villages I was the first white man they'd seen ever, let alone a white monk. They'd never seen a white person before. And so, you know, no TV, no electricity or anything like that, so they couldn't see anything on the TV And I was the first white person. I remember going on alms round in this village. And, you know, all the people that, you've got your bowl, and they're supposed to be putting rice in the bowl. They weren't looking in the bowl, they're looking at me and dropping it outside. Because I was the first white person they'd ever seen. And actually, you know, there's one of the Thai people here, you know, she comes very regularly. She said she was a young girl in that area. She said, I remember I was a young girl and I saw this white monk come in the village. It was the first white person we'd ever seen. And it could have been me. And I think, it's amazing just how that, you know, people are connected together. It's not just coincidence. There's something else going on there. So you don't have to have anger. When they say the five things you're supposed to have, that is culturally specific. And if you're a Buddhist, you don't need to have that anger. It's not you're suppressing it, it's just not there. And this is one of the problems, because there was one lady, you know, in our Armadale group some time ago, that she came for counselling because her friend said she's in really big trouble. What the trouble was she had two twins, boy and a girl, Donna and Damon, still remember their names. They were 11 years of age, and the teacher in school had discovered that they were being sexually abused by their father. And, you know, the teacher could see the signs, interviewed them, and sure enough, the father was sexually abusing his two children. And this, she was a mother. And she was totally sort of confused, upset, just because she still loved her husband. And she found that her husband had been sexually abusing her children. And she also had that motherly protection, which was now turned to guilt. She had failed to protect her children. And she couldn't understand why she couldn't see that. It's obvious why she can't see that, because it's a psychology of denial. You just can't see what is just so abhorrent. You know, the signs were there, but, you know, it was automatically, subconsciously blocked from her mind, because facing up to that was just so terrible. But because, you know, she'd been meditating, she was a Buddhist, she quickly came to terms with it, you know, with a bit of help from me. And then she got into trouble with a counsellor, because she had to go through counselling. It was legally enforced that she had to have a counsellor. And the counsellor kept on saying, "You're angry at him, aren't you?" She said, "No, I'm not. I don't love him anymore. There's no way that I can actually stay with him. But I'm not angry at him. You know, it's a bad thing to do, but anger is not going to help anybody." It was a Buddhist response, and she was actually doing it. She wasn't angry at him. You know, she didn't love him anymore, but, you know, she wasn't really wanting to hurt him or anything. And it got so bad, she came to see me again. She said, "Look, it's bad enough going through all of this, but this counselor will not let me go until I admit I'm angry at my husband, but I'm not." And I had to write a long letter to this counsellor, you know, about Buddhist principles, saying, "I know this lady. I've been talking to her much longer than you have. You know, she's let that one go. She's not angry at her husband, at her ex. You know, he actually had to go to jail. See, I don't wish him any harm at all. Now, obviously, I don't agree with what he's done, but anger is not going to help anybody, certainly not my children." And I was very impressed with her because, you know, I knew her children. Because the mother wasn't angry, the children let it go pretty quickly too, and they didn't carry that trauma around like other people do carry trauma around. And it was brilliant. I'm very proud of her that she managed to respond to that very difficult situation in life in a really Buddhist way, which was not understood by the counsellors, and I had to intervene to get her free from that counsellor, and she's fine. I lost contact with her. She went over to England, but she kept on writing for years, and the children were growing up. I think Donna got married and had a kid, so, you know, they were fine. Kept in contact. But now that's maybe 5 years ago, it's the last time I've heard from them. So that's what happened. It's not always the same. Sometimes you can let go. It's not sort of blocking out the anger, it's just not there. And just, you know, like me, like my mother died about 2 years ago. I haven't got grief for my mother dying. And this is my mother. I've only got one. and I love her very much. But, you know, she died. She had a very good life. She had dementia at the end. And when she died, my view was that she had been released from a prison. Well done, Mum. Congratulations. There's no grief, no tears, no sadness. A sense of completion of a good life. It's a Buddhist way of looking at things. Am I weird? I'm certainly not suppressing anything. I know what's inside of me. There's just no grief there. Isn't that a much better way to look at life? Instead of all this grief and anger. And unfortunately, much of grief in our modern world is imposed by our culture. You are supposed to cry, you know, when somebody, you know, your father dies. And if you don't cry when your father dies, people look at you and say, don't you love him? You know, have you got this bad relationship with your father? You're not crying. What's wrong with you? And it's almost as if you're forced to cry. It's cultural peer pressure. But you don't need to. There's another way of looking at things. And I like that other way of looking at things. It's far more sensible. Just even the Irish, they don't cry at funerals, they have a wake. You know, they have a celebration when somebody dies. Isn't that a much better way to die, have a wake? It reminds me of the old story about the, you know, the only difference between an Irish wedding and an Irish funeral? The difference between an Irish wedding and an Irish funeral. An Irish funeral is one less drunk. The one in the box. Okay, that's it. But you know, that why not celebrate a life instead of mourn a death? Anyway, can you tell more about young Gotama's experience of jhana? Can kids experience it? Yeah, they can. But a lot of times they don't know what's happening. What I've found out all these years I've been teaching, that so many people can experience these jhanas, they sort of fluke it. They just press the letting go button and they have these great experiences. It's just like that when I was teaching a retreat in Penang many years ago. Again, they said there's a person here who's having a lot of psychological problems. The counselors and psychologists and psychiatrists in Penang couldn't help her, so Ajahn Brahm, the last resort. So I said, okay, I'll talk to her. And of course, I didn't know what the problem was. She came in, she said she had this experience. It was amazing. I said, wow, you've had a jhana. And I told her a few other things which she had experienced, which she hadn't told me. Just to convince her that I knew what I was talking about. And she was so amazed and happy. She said, yes, that's what it was. At last someone knows what I went through. I said, it's a jhana. This is what happens. You probably won't get one again. You just fluked it. But you know, that's what it was. You're not going crazy. That's just the nature of the mind when it presses the letting go button. So she walked out, one little happy Penangy. You know, just, you know, she knew what it was. She wasn't crazy. It was just a jhana she'd gone through. She'd fluke one. And so many times that happens. Well, not many times, but it's quite a few people. They come up and they tell me something which happened to them in their life, and I listen to them, and it's exactly what happened. I know exactly what these things are. And I say, yeah, that was a jhana. And just to convince them, I always add a few extra details which they hadn't told me, which I know about occurs in those states. And, you know, they're convinced. Wow, yeah, that was what it was. So some people do fluke them. If we can be enlightened as a layperson, what is the reason for joining the Sangha? You know, it is possible for you to go back to, for those of you coming from the eastern states, it's possible to go back to Sydney by walking. You can do that. But you'd be an idiot to walk back to Sydney when you can get a cheap air flight for $200 or something. Now, who would actually walk to Sydney from Perth? You're crazy, because it's a much easier way when you go by aircraft. Yes, you can become enlightened being a lay person, but you're crazy when there's this beautiful flight business class in the Sangha. You get there much quicker, less tired if you join the Sangha. That's why the Sangha is there for. It's easier. That's why the Buddha designed it, so people can get enlightened quicker, faster, with much more ease. But yeah, you can become enlightened as a layperson. You can walk to Sydney. But I wouldn't recommend it. Where do I follow the breath in meditation? Do I need to label it as in or out? No. You can if you want to. But, you know, that's only the beginning. If you label it in or out, just to try and suppress some of the random thoughts. But, you know, only the beginning. After a while, you know it's in, you know it's out. You don't need to sort of, you know, act like a sergeant major at an army camp. In, out, in, out, in, out, in, out. Come on, keep up. In, out. It just gets sort of quite boring. However, if you do want to play around, I'll give you another little exercise. Oh, I've already started this now. Another little exercise. Now, when I say go, I want you to close your eyes, breathe in and out three times, and then open your eyes after, you know, the third out breath. Okay? Go. And after the third out breath, open your eyes. Very good. Some of you can't count, or you stop breathing, I don't know what. So, next, I want you to do the same exercise again, when I say go, but I want you to start with an out breath. Breathe out first, and then in. Out, in, out, in. Okay, go. And after the third in breath, open your eyes. Now you would have discovered that's totally different. In, out, in, out, in, out is totally different than out, in, out, in, out, in. So I call that backwards breath meditation. You start with the out breath and then you breathe in. It just makes it a little bit interesting. You are messing around with your head and making it more mindful and more aware. So if you want to be playful, try backwards breath meditation. Invented for the first time in 2,500 years by Ajahn Brahm. No one else has ever done that before. Like kangaroo meditation, invented by me too. I'm an innovator in meditation techniques. But try the, you know, it just makes it interesting so you don't get bored. That's like in-out, it's supposed to just make it a little bit interesting. But see if you can try backwards breath meditation. Out, in, out, in. You find it makes you much more mindful. As long as I watch the whole process in detail, do I need to know the fact that whether it's now the in state or the out state? Do I need to continue to have the concept now it is in the breathing in state, the breathing out state? No, you don't. Just at the beginning, just to make the breath interesting. And after a while, once you know the breath and it's very clear to you, you don't need to know whether it's in or out at all. Dear Ajahn, control comes from ego. The wiser one is the less one controls. This bears great fruits in meditation, but when it comes to being involved in politics or in running monasteries, how does it work? Easy. Delegate. So you don't control. You give the work to other people. And if it works, you take the praise because your wisdom in delegating to the right people. And if it fails, you've got someone to blame. Either way, you know, you're off the hook. So I do that a lot here. In Ajahna Grove, I delegate that to Dania and Mike and Burse. Anything goes wrong, they're the ones to blame. By the end of the retreat, say, oh, wonderful retreat. I said, yes, thank you so much. Because of my great wisdom, delegating to the right people. But that's how you stop controlling things. And that in life, you know, just why are people you can't delegate? Why do you do that? On Friday night, that's what day is it today? Tuesday today. Only three more days, I'm delegating the questions and answers to these two nuns and to this monk and to the teddy bears. Because I'll be off in Nolamara. So I delegate. So isn't that wonderful? So you can answer the questions. It's really good fun. You can really ask some tough questions. You know, they've been sitting up here, you've been feeding them, bowing to them, so see what they're made of. And because I think, who's the senior here? suppose, you know, you must be the senior. So if it's a question, you know, you think, this is a tough one, I delegate this question to Venkat. That's the way to do things in life. So if the wise ones stand back passively, then doesn't this allow the control freaks with the big egos to rise to the front? That is a good question, but if you, you know, put things in a good way, then the control freaks can't survive. Like the Buddha, that's what he did. And the Buddha set up the system so control freaks just can't survive. You know, you have to let go. You know, if you're controlling all the time as a monk, you can't meditate. You get stressed out, and obviously people see that you just get angry at everybody. That's the sign of a control freak. You always get angry. And of course, if that happens in a monastery, you know, you lose your faith in such people. You don't support them anymore. So there is like a mechanism which weeds out the control freaks in a monastery. And it's also they don't like staying. They've got no happiness. So perhaps, you know, I had a very interesting experience. The first time I gave a really, really big talk, I think it was over in Singapore once, and it was about 3,000-4,000 people. You know, in a convention center setting. And as I walked up, there's all these people, they're just listening to me. There was no second act, no supporting people at all. Just me in this stage, totally alone with about 3,000-4,000 people, taking that evening off just to listen to me. And when I looked at that, I thought, is this your ego I jump on? You know, that you, all these people come to listen to you. And I just had this great insight. I can only do this. And if I disappear, if I have absolutely no ego at all, as soon as I start thinking of how I'm going to perform in such a big crowd, I would blow it. I would just not be able to perform at all. And so I realized that my training, Ajahn Chah trained me to sort of let go of my ego. And that's the only way you can give a good talk to so many people without being tense. Vanish. And then you can give really nice talks. So that's, you know, one of my tricks. When sometimes I give these talks to huge groups of people, 10,000 people. I think 7,000 in the stadium in Korea next month they booked me for. You know, in the stadium giving a talk, you know, to thousands of people. How the hell can you do that? And if I have one bit of ego in there, I will stuff up. So I just vanish and disappear, no ego at all. And then actually it works. You can give nice talks and you have fun too. So that's, you know, there is a mechanism here in this monastic life. Now, if you start getting egos, you know, you fail every time. But if you let go, you can actually do amazing things. And when it gets to, I get back to monastery, these monks, they put me in my place. You know, I go into my cave, and there's no sort of, you know, you're not with Queen Elizabeth anymore, having two cheeses and one chocolate. You're back in your little cave, sleeping on the floor. So that's great. And, you know, sometimes you see that I always make sure that every now and again I do some hard physical labor. You know, and sometimes Daniel's got me working on the roof of the teacher's cottage, pictures of me working. And sometimes you just say, get down off that roof, Ajahn Brahm. You're not supposed to be on the roof. You're too heavy. It will collapse. Have you checked that off? But I have to do that just to, you know, to make sure I do something physical and labour and just so you're not always just this big shot. So is there any way to control from a place other than ego? Are we destined to have less wise as our leaders, the wise giving way to them? No, it's actually that, you know, there is a way that you get the real big leaders, like an Ajahn Chah, no ego at all, like a Buddha, no ego. So you do get really good leaders, a Mandela. You know, Gandhi. Who's the other one with very few? Sorry? Aung San Suu Kyi. There's lots of leaders like that, and they're the really good ones, the really high quality ones. No ego at all. Or very, very small egos. So anyway, what is right action in Buddhism? It's not harming anybody, including yourself. Dear Ajahn, this is an official complaint. Ha ha. Burr, Dania, please. No, I think this is a bit of a joke.
With extremely cheap 6-star accommodation, you don't pay very much and it's 6 stars, in a pollution-free paradise, surrounded by scenic forests and animals, spoiled by friendly staff, kind fellow meditators and a relaxing schedule, accompanied by 2 world-class entertainment sessions every morning and evening, self-service free flow of tea, coffee, chocolate and milk, full continental and Asian breakfast and international buffet lunch. This is the complaint, by the way. Here comes the complaint. I'm in big trouble. I have gained 2 kilograms every day. I'm still counting. That's the complaint. You haven't gained weight. Your heart has got bigger. That's very nice. It is a very nice retreat. Dear Ajahn, I often see flashes of light and figure lights on the corner of my eye, like if someone is standing next to me. What is that? I'm checking up on you. You think I'm not watching. I know what you're up to. No, it's not me. And on photos there appear to be lights or orbs. Why do we see these things? Okay, first of all, on the corner of your eye, you know, that's a place where lots of imagination can happen. Perception can play all sorts of tricks on the corner of your eye. If it's in the center of your eye, that's a bit more interesting. Flashes of light come up, that's quite natural, that's not the nirvanas yet. And the orbs, have you seen these photographs? And they have orbs on them. I saw this photograph in a monastery in KL years ago. And it was a photograph of a Tibetan monk with this big orb right over his heart. And the photograph was on top of the donation box for his monastery. That was fraud. That was a scam. What he was saying, look, I've got an orb. I must be holy. Put some money in the box. But the truth of the matter is, and I know this as a scientist, you should know this too, that's dust particles. You can see orbs in casinos. You can see orbs in nightclubs. You don't get self-respecting heavenly beings going to nightclubs or pubs or these other places where you see orbs. It's just dust particles, that's all. I remember when people went, the first time they went to India with me, they had all these dust particles in Bodh Gaya and in Kusinara. They think, wow, there's so many devas in these places. And I said, no, India is so dusty. That's why you have all these particles. And experiments have been done. These aren't heavenly beings. It's not supernatural. It's just dust. It's a diffraction pattern. The flash of the light gets on the dust, diffracts it, and it reflects back into the camera. That's on your pictures. That's all it is. But some people say, no, that was a heavenly being. Look, it's an orb over my chest. I'm a holy nun. Please give lots of money to our temple. That's fraud. Which of the 6 realms do ghosts belong to? Thanks. Your realm. If they belong to some other realm, you wouldn't see them. They belong to this realm. They belong to Jhana Grove, your cottage, your room number. That's where they belong. Now you're quite safe. Look, as I mentioned, you know, nuns, monks, even lay people, you've got force field around you. Remember, indigenous elders, they couldn't get into the monastery where I was staying. So ghosts, they can't get in here, okay? They're forbidden. They've got to get permission from me, first of all. Maybe sometimes I might give them permission to come and visit you. No, I wouldn't do that. So they're fine. You're perfectly safe here. This morning you mentioned the hell's angels and pest exterminator getting into jhana. On the other hand, monks and nuns observing hundreds of refined precepts may not experience jhana their whole life. How then do you explain the necessary link between sila and samadhi? Are there other more important influences, such as karma or past life experiences? So many different influences which make one get into deep meditation. But the ones who've got very strong sila, they've got really strong foundations. Yeah, it may take them longer, but when their jhana happens, that's a big one, that's a huge one, because they've got really nice foundations. Sometimes this guy, he wasn't a Hell's Angel, he just looked like one. He's a very nice guy when you get to know him, but on the outside he looked really fierce. And there's even the pest exterminator, that was his job. It was a really nice, kind, generous guy, would go and sacrifice his time helping in the prisons. Really nice guy. So yeah, it's not just the job, it's not just the fact that you've got tattoos on your arm. There's much more to life than that, much more to a person than that. And just because you're a monk, sometimes people have a hard time as a monk, sometimes have a lovely time as a monk or as a nun. But as a monk or a nun, you really are building up a huge amount of good karma, goodness. So you're working on other factors of the Eightfold Path, especially the right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And if you get, and also, just, you know, the right thought and right intention, that gets so strong. It's only a matter of time. Yeah, they may not have been focusing on the samadhi part of their path, but the other part is so strong and so pure. When they do get into the samadhi, it really develops very quickly. So that's really what really happens. During meditation, I'm not fully in the present moment. Sometime in the past, sometimes in the future. But why I feel a lot of joy come from my heart? Because you are sometimes in the present moment. And you'll have even more joy in your heart if you spend more time in the present moment. So this is what it's like now. Imagine what it's like when you're really in the present moment. Wow! So, make it better. Can nimittā jhāna be experienced outside of a retreat? Of course it can, but the best is within a retreat. Because you know, everything is supporting you here. So it can be done. And sometimes it's like the simile of the paycheck. Sometimes you do all the work, and then when you leave, maybe a week, 2 weeks later, you get your paycheck in the mail. And sometimes, this is a great simile, sometimes you do all the work on a retreat, you meditate and meditate and meditate, and after 9 days you don't get anything. And a few days later you're at home, and you're just meditating in your bedroom, and wham bam, you get into a deep meditation. You get the paycheck. It's just delayed, but you notice because of all the work you've done during the retreat. So sometimes that happens as well. Delayed paycheck. Dear Ajahn, you have taught us that mindfulness is one of the elements of meditation. Our daily life is full of various activities, and to accomplish each activity meaningfully, mindfulness is of utmost importance. Does it fall within the ambit of meditation? Not really, because you call meditation stillness. Mindfulness is great, but it's not enough. Just every fortnight, I have to give a little teaching to the nuns, Dhammasara nuns this morning, and that's why I was on the phone at 10:15. And the one which I gave them today, a little teaching, is called the Manibhadra Yaka Sanyutta, where this heavenly being, who's like a yaka, not a very high one, came and saw the Buddha, and he said this poem, like, it's good to be mindful, the mindful live happily and they don't get angry. And the Buddha replied, well, the mindful, it's good to be mindful, the mindful live happily, but the mindful still get angry. And he said, you should live mindful and also cultivating thoughts of harmlessness by day or night, cultivating loving kindness all the time, and then you don't get angry. It's a wonderful little saying, because people say, oh, just be mindful. And the Buddha, that's one place he says specifically, mindfulness is not enough. You'll still get angry. You have to develop loving kindness as well. You need stillness as well. You need the whole Eightfold Path. So in your daily life, you can be as mindful as you like, but you'll get angry at yourself and your husband, your wife, your kids, your workers. It's much more than mindfulness is needed. When do insights come up in meditation? And would they ever include a bad premonition? That's not an insight when you have a bad premonition. And anyway, there's no such thing as a premonition that something bad is going to happen. The future is uncertain. You don't know what's going to happen next. You may have a bad premonition that something terrible is going to happen, and it doesn't. Something much worse happens. Or not the same. So sometimes the premonitions, they can't be trusted. One of the monks I sat next to for years, he told me, he was this American monk, and he told me, because, you know, sitting next to each other, tell all stories to each other, that he had three premonitions in his life. You know, that there's very strong dreams or premonitions, and the first was his sister drowning in the family pool. His father, he was actually in military intelligence in the Vietnam War, and, you know, quite a wealthy man. And so they had this wonderful little house in Pasadena in L.A. And, you know, he had this premonition of his sister drowning in the pool. And one day he was just lounging by the pool, and the premonition started to actually happen. And because he had the premonition before, he knew what was going to happen next. And he took action and he saved his sister's life. And he said if he didn't have that premonition, his sister would be dead. And he said that showed the premonition was actually real. The second premonition he had was when he was, you know, he was in his early 20s and he was visiting New Zealand, staying in a house with other young men. And he had a premonition that the police raided their house and arrested them all for taking marijuana. He had that premonition. And the problem was, he was taking so much marijuana, he didn't really sort of act on it. So the police came, they arrested him. And he got deported back to the US. And he kicked himself. I had the premonition the police were going to come and never acted on it. And so it's two out of three. The third one he had, and he kept on telling me this, like, I know it's going to happen, that, you know, the Viet Cong are going to invade northeast Thailand, and, you know, we're going to get caught up in it, and I'm going to get killed by running across a paddy field, shot in the back of the head. He said, I know it's going to happen. You know, at that time, many Western governments did really feel that the communists would invade Thailand, especially the northeast where we were. Where we were, from where we were to Hanoi was half the distance than it was to Bangkok. We were so close to Cambodia, Laos and Vietnam. So it was a real possibility. But of course, you know, it never happened. And he got killed in a head-on car crash coming back from Yosemite National Park. And his premonition was wrong. And that really sometimes shows you that sometimes premonitions are right, but sometimes they're just totally wrong. And you can't tell the difference between the two. Which is why that you don't know if premonition, if it's going to be true or not. The best thing is just not to even believe them. So when insights come up in meditation, they come up naturally, that when you are still, you start to see things as they truly are. I'll give a talk on insights tomorrow, because people keep on about insight meditation. So insight meditation tomorrow morning. Should people of a high spiritual power having psychic abilities give a person doom and gloom predictions without any message of hope? Because isn't life a mixture of good and bad? Of course it's good and bad. Anyone who gives you a prediction of doom and gloom are just a crazy. They're mad. And anyway, I always say, do not trust a fortune teller if they're poor. If they can't tell their own fortune, how can they tell yours? So I was in Hong Kong. Hong Kong got this whole street of fortune tellers. And I went down to have a look at them. And they were all just, you know, wearing, no, not very good clothes anyway. And just, these people, why do you trust these people? If they could tell the fortune, why don't they tell what's going to happen in the stock market, in the horse racing, clean up once, and they wouldn't have to go to work on these cold nights in Hong Kong street. They can't even tell their own fortune. How on earth can they tell yours? Dear Ajahn, are patterns of behavior like lying carried forward from past lives? How to help a child undo this habitual pattern? Is it necessary to tell someone you've adopted that she is an adopted child, although she is well loved? That's a choice for you, you know, to tell them they're adopted or not adopted, because the most important thing is to tell them they're loved. Anyway, they're all adopted anyway. Even the the biological. You know, you only give the body, you know, to the person, but, you know, where they come from, they're adopted. Of course they're adopted. You adopt their stream of consciousness from the previous life. So all children are adopted. But, you know, the body is yours. You know, the body comes from the parents. But, you know, their personality, their character, that doesn't come from their mum and dad. Does it? I was a Buddhist. My mother and father weren't Buddhists. You know, they just gave me the body. You know, the person inside of this, that came from somewhere else totally. So, you know, they adopted, you know, the most important part of me. They just gave me the car, the body I've been driving for all these years. So, you can tell them they're adopted if you want. But, you know, just to see whether, as long as they feel secure, they feel safe, they feel love with you, then they can accept that. But if they're already pretty insecure, they don't feel safe, then one more thing to say they're adopted, that might just, they're not really ready for that. But if everything else in their life is going well, then you can tell them that, and it just doesn't really matter to them. Yeah, I'm adopted, so what? You know, you're my mum, you're my dad, and that's it. Patterns of behavior carried forward from past lives. Yeah, there is some of those patterns carried forward from past lives. That's why for parents, you know, that sometimes parents, they have a kid, and the kid is a terrible kid. And the parents are just wonderful parents. And then where did this kid come from? And that, you know, reincarnation explains so much. You know, that even the best gardener in the world, if they've got a bad seed, can't make it grow into a beautiful tree. And other people, other parents, are terrible parents. But the seed is so good, no matter what the parents do, you know, the child grows up into a wonderful kid. So it's not just the parents, it's just what they're working with. So that's why that you can't feel guilty, you know, if you have a kid and they don't turn out that well. And you shouldn't feel proud if you've got a kid and they turn out to be so wonderful. It's not your fault. Because it's where they come from, it's something else to them. Dear Ajahn, I'm pretty good at letting go of the past, but I spend a lot of time planning and dreaming of my future happiness. Can you please talk about how to find the balance between planning ahead and being in the moment in relation to being happy with thanks? If you feel like it, please tell a ghost story. Well, we'll see. But in the future. Look, if you do plan the future, I say please keep all plans out of rubber, not out of concrete. So you can change the plans at a moment's notice. Remember that telling business people that business conditions, economic conditions, they change so quickly. And if you can't adapt almost immediately, if you've got your business plan and the way you do things, and you can't change immediately, now you end up losing so many opportunities and just ruining your company. Now you have to adapt. New technology might come up, and you just hear about it. Now economic openings are there, and if it doesn't fit in your plans, you can't take advantage of it. Which is one of the reasons why you may make plans, but make them totally tentative, able to be changed at a moment's notice. Which means, you know, you get your all of you going overseas when the retreat finishes. Who knows? There might be a strike at the airport. So you should be willing to change your plans at a moment's notice. It might not work out. Somebody might die and you have to leave early. You've got to be willing to change your plans. Who knows? You might get enlightened. You have to be willing to change your plans and become a monk or a nun. You don't know what's going to happen. Which is one of the reasons why that you have sort of plans, but just keep them just fluid. And now, a ghost story. Okay, now what ghost story should I say? How many of you, put your hand up, here we go. How many of you want to hear the coffin story again? If you've heard the coffin ghost story, put your hand up. If you haven't heard it, put your hand up. Well, there's enough of you who haven't heard it. And if you have, it's just the tradition on retreat is to hear the coffin story. So please, Daniel, the lights. This is very good. This is a spooky ghost story. There was a friend. He was listening to a talk in the temple. And when the talk had finished, it was late. And he was having to walk home. Now there were two ways to get home. One was the long way round. The shortcut was through the cemetery. It was late at night. And he didn't believe in ghosts. So what the hell, I'll take the shortcut through the cemetery. And it was very dark and very still and very spooky. But he walked at a natural pace, actually quite faster than usual, through the cemetery. He got to the halfway mark. Okay, everything is safe, everything is normal, nothing is happening. And just past the halfway mark, he had the feeling, just a feeling, that's all, that something was following him. And quite automatically, he started walking a bit faster. And when he got to three quarters through the cemetery, he could swear he could hear something following after him. So he started walking even faster. And whatever it was following him also went faster. And by the time he got to the front gates of the cemetery, he could hear it very clearly coming after him. Bump, 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 following him. And he tried to stop himself from looking around. He was so afraid of seeing what this was. But he couldn't help himself. He glanced around, and as soon as he did that, he wished he never had. Because what he saw following him was a coffin. A vertical coffin with dirt falling off it, with cobwebs covering it, coming after him. Bump, bump, bump. No more walking. He ran as fast as he could. And he could hear it coming after him. Bump, 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 bump. He was catching up. He ran like hell. Fast and faster. But however fast he ran, bump, 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 it ran even faster. And he, fortunately, his house was very close by. Now he had one of these garden gates, a little path to his door. He didn't open the garden gate, he jumped over it. Bump, bump, bump. He got to the front door as the coffin got to the gate. And he reached in for his bunch of keys and he dropped them. Bump! As the coffin broke down the garden gate, it was coming towards him on the path. Bump, bump, bump. He took out a key, any key, slid it into the lock, hoping for it was the right key. He was so lucky. It was the right key. He turned the lock, jumped inside, and slammed the door just as the coffin reached the front door. He could see it through the glass. Only a few inches in front of him, but he had the door protecting him from the coffin. He felt safe. He was sweating. His heart was pounding. He felt so tired. Bump! As the coffin started to hit the door. Bump! Even louder. Bump! The hinges started to give way. Bump! The wood started to split. He raced up the stairs. Bump! As the coffin broke down the front door of his house, he was terrified. At the top of the stairs, he looked down at the coffin. And the coffin looked up at him. Bump, bump, bump. As the coffin started climbing the stairs. He ran into the only room with a lock, the bathroom. And he heard the coffin come up the stairs. Bump! Against the bathroom door. He was really scared. He knew he had no hope. If that coffin could destroy the front door of your house, the bathroom door would soon give way. Bump! As the bathroom door started to give way. Bump! He didn't laugh. He was scared. Bump! As the coffin broke through. And there was no other place to go. He was spread-eagled against the wall as the coffin came through. Just few feet between him and the coffin in the bathroom. He was done for. Intuitively, there was a bottle on the shelf. He picked up that bottle and threw it at the coffin as the coffin came towards him. And the bottle shattered over the coffin, and this brown liquid went all over the coffin. And the coffin stopped. The coffin never moved again. Because that bottle was a bottle of cough mixture, cough medicine. It stops the coffin. That is one of the worst jokes. And I cannot resist telling it. Cough mix, cough medicine, it stops the coughing. Okay, very good. And if you've heard it before, you still laugh. Is full moon day a good day? Why monk's day is a full moon day? Why some people don't like a full moon day? Will full moon day change my behaviour? Thank you. Jeepers. Full moon day is a good day. Every day is a good day when you're in the temple. Why monk's day is a full moon day? Because, you know, the full moon, full tummy, they go together. Why some people don't like a full moon day? Because they have to go to the temple and they have to keep precepts. Because people have to keep precepts on a full moon day, so on a full moon day you can't do this and you can't do that. So that's why a lot of people don't like full moon day. And why full moon day changed my behaviour? Because you come to the temple, and coming to the temple changes your behaviour. You have to make it up as you go along. How do you handle angry people? Many thanks. Number one, you divorce them. Oops, I shouldn't say that. No, angry people, they try and control you with their anger. So don't allow yourself to be influenced at all. Angry people, they can shout at me, they can, but I'm just going to be there and smile. You get angry as you like. Because when you don't sort of respond to their anger, it's a waste of time. They have this old simile that if you give a gift to someone and they don't receive it, who's left with the gift? No, the original donor is left with the gift. It gets returned to you. So if someone gets angry at me and I don't get upset back, you know, that it belongs to the person who tried to make me angry. Now that really upsets people. They try and get angry at you and you refuse to get upset. That really pisses them off. It does. They're trying to make you angry and you just sit here happy as ever. So that's why sometimes that don't respond to anger, because you're just feeding it and encouraging them to get angry again. So that's one of the best ways. Just don't respond to it. It's just crazy people. Well, the second way, the old story of this, there we go, the husband who had the afternoon off work. Did I tell the story already? Husband had the afternoon off work and his wife said, darling, I need some eggs to make the dinner. Can you please go to the market and get some eggs? And the husband said, I've never been to the market before. You have to give me instructions. So the wife gave instructions on how to get to the market, where to go and how to buy the eggs. And the husband happily helped his dear wife. And as soon as he got into the marketplace, this young man came right up to this husband and said, "You are the ugliest person I've ever seen in my whole life. You've got a face like a camel. The backside of a camel, that is. And I don't know what aftershave you use, but it smells of dog poo." And he was just so angry and said such really nasty words to this husband. And it was in public, in a marketplace. And her husband got so embarrassed. "I don't even know you. Why are you telling these terrible things to me?" And that just encouraged this young man. This young man got so angry and cursed him, gave him all sorts of bad names. And the husband just turned around and went home. He got back home, he slammed the door. His wife said, "You're early, darling." "Yeah, never send me to that stupid market ever again. They're a terrible place. People are just so uncouth and uncivilized. You wouldn't believe what they said to me. I don't even know the person. They were so horrible to me. I don't want to go there ever again. Why do you go to that market?" I enjoy doing that. You know, usually I have to be so peaceful and calm. So when I give stories like this, I can actually, you know, enjoy myself. Anyway, so when he calmed down, the wife said, "No, what happened?" And then he said about this young boy, and she said, "Oh, it's him. Because that poor boy, he had an accident when he was very small. He fell over and hit his head, and his brain damaged. Now the poor boy will never be able to go to school. And he will never get a job, never find a nice girl to get married to and share his life with. The boy's crazy. He just hangs around the market. You know, he says worse things to me, worse things to everybody. But we know who he is. He's a crazy boy." And as soon as the husband realized that he'd been cursed and abused by someone who had brain damage, he wasn't angry anymore. And as soon as his wife saw he calmed down, she said to him, "Darling, I still need those eggs." So, "Okay, I'll go and get it for you." So off he went, back to the market, and this young boy saw him again. And as then, here comes camel face, here comes dog poo. This time he didn't get upset at all. Even though this boy was getting angry at him and giving him all sorts of names, the husband calmly went to the egg store, bought the eggs and went home again. Because how can you get angry, you know, and being sort of cursed out by a crazy person? And the moral of that story is this. If you men go home and your wife starts scolding you and calling you all sorts of bad names, just assume that she's hit her head that day and it's temporary brain damage. So if anyone gets angry at me and calls me names, "You lazy bum of a monk, you should get a proper job. Why do you, you know, take all these donations? You know, they all feed you. You should do something for all of that, you lazy monk." I just assume they've hit their head and their brain damaged. "Oh, you poor thing." Well, that's how to deal with anger. Anyone gets angry, if they go back to work when you leave this retreat and your boss gets angry at you, just says, "Brain damage, brain damage." "You poor boss." If you have time, can you please tell the story of the Australian man in the Himalayan temple at Mystical Sounds? This is a true story. Okay, I'll tell that another day because you already had the one stupid story today. You can't tell too many stupid stories in the same evening. Ajahn Brahm, I've heard before. This is a similar question to yesterday. I've heard before that it is bad karma for parents to prevent their children becoming a monk or nun. It's different culture with Westerners when they reach 20. Parents can say, "Off you go." In fact, parents can't say, "Off you go," quick enough in the West. A few years ago, I wanted to become a nun, but I knew they don't allow, and I myself didn't want them to have that bad karma as my gratitude. They're in the 70s and 80s, and they just want to see me to be happily married. Isn't that an oxymoron? When you have two words which don't mean the same, happily and married. Oh, come on, marriage. You know the three rings of marriage? Remember the three rings of marriage? What's the first ring? Engagement ring. The second ring?
Amen.
Wedding ring, the third ring.
Amen.
Supper ring, yeah. You know the story of the man who just, he didn't know what happiness was until he met his wife, and that time was too late. Or the guy when he was going out with his girlfriend would hold her hand in love. After 30 years of marriage, he still holds his wife's hand. Out of self-defense. I know lots of marriage jokes. And why are you laughing? Because it's true, that's why. On the guy on his 40th marriage anniversary said, you know, even in murder they only give you 30 years, I've got 40. But anyway, some marriages are happy. If you get it right, well done. But, you know, sometimes you want you to be happily married. They don't want you happily married, they want you to be happy. And for some people, it is marriage is happiness for them. In some marriages, not the way they can be happy. They need to be a monk or a nun. They need to be single to be happy. So please, you parents, you want your children to be happy, and it's not necessarily married. Unfortunately, my preference is a spiritual path, so I never ask them. I still practice as a lay people and attend retreats. I may become a nun one day, maybe not, just so be it. Now, sometimes that's really sad, for me anyway, that, you know, the parents, they want you to be married, and you probably, you know, you got married, and you probably made a really good job of it, well done. But, you know, sometimes you feel you're missing out on something in life. And so, you know, that what you're missing out on, you know, the spiritual life is really sad. So please, if you ever have children, don't do the same to them. If your child says, yeah, I want to become a monk, or I want to become a nun, then give them that opportunity, that chance. You may not have had it, but please give it to somebody else. And it's a beautiful, beautiful lifestyle. You can make people so happy. You can spend your life telling stupid jokes in the evening about coffins bumping down the road. And you can let people sort of overcome their problems, get them enlightened. So it's a great life as a monk or a nun. And there's not enough really good monks and nuns around in our world, so it's great to have more of them. And I don't know why it is, but you know, I have to go to Sri Lanka in June. I don't know why. I'm a Western monk. You've got enough monks in Sri Lanka already. Why do you have to import them from Australia? You should be sending them over here. So there's not enough good monks and nuns in the whole world. That's why, you know, the poor senior monks in this monastery have to travel so much. And we try not to have that in the future. In the future, there's really good monks all over the world, so I can relax and just have a nice, easy life. But we need help. So please, if you want to be a monk or a nun, please come and become a monk or a nun. And it's a wonderful life, like many people do these days. And it's so inspiring. You know, you can really, really help people. And in my room, in the little office, I've got this drawer, not a drawer, it's a cupboard, and I stuff all these letters in it. And there are people who say, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, I've been listening to your talks. Without those talks on YouTube, I'd be dead now. And without you, or without those books, without those talks, you know, I had cancers, and the cancer's now gone. I had, my marriage was really just broken, and I read or listened to you, and now I'm living happily with my husband and my kids again. It's incredible the amount of really good work which has happened over those years. And that gives me so much fulfillment. I want you to be as fulfilled as well. And not only that, the happiness you have inside yourself by practicing. It's the best lifestyle of all. Why not? I know one reason why not, because we're all full. Bodhinyana Monastery in Dharamsala. We've got other monasteries, we're getting up over in Santi Monastery, over in Sydney, over Jagannath is here from Victoria, they're building a big monastery over there. We've got monasteries in the United States and other parts of the world. We're franchising. So yeah, be part of it and have a wonderful life as a monk or a nun. You don't have to be young to be a monk or a nun. In the time of the Buddha, there was one guy, 120 years of age, and he ordained as a monk. And he ordained at 120, he got enlightened a couple of months later, and he died about a month after that. He left it to the very end, but he just got in. So there you go, it's a chance for you. There we go. Okay, well, that's the last question. The one about Himalayas I'll leave for another day. So, there we go. That's the entertainment over this evening. Now you've got to go boring sleep. Sadhu. Sadhu.